Over 25 years ago, on September 29th, 1998, we watched a brainy girl with curly hair drop everything to follow a guy she only kind of knew all the way to college. And so began Felicity. My name is Juliette Littman, and I'm a Felicity superfan. Join me, Amanda Foreman, who you may know better as Megan, the roommate, and Greg Grunberg, who you may also know as Sean Blunberg, as the three of us revisit our favorite moments from the show and talk to the people who helped shape it. Listen to Dear Felicity, presented by Walmart on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The Podfix Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 216 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to...
Bugger them up.
In our very, very humble opinion. Today we are talking to fantastic director Jamie Patterson, who has made 16 movies. In 10 years. I'm Giles Alderson, I'm a writer, director, and a producer, and joining me today as my co-host is the brilliant Dom Lemoire. Hello, buddy.
Hi, Giles, how's it going?
Very good. Now, Dom, if you don't know, has directed three feature films, one of which, Winter Ridge, is out now. Go watch it. It's fabulous. It's on Amazon Prime. You have nothing to lose. And when you have watched it, give it a brilliant review. So, Jamie Patterson, so those of you who don't know his work, I'm sure you do. He's just fantastic. Some of the movies he's made, like Dom, he made a movie when he was 19, his first film, which was called Swimming in Circles. Then he went on and directed Confession, Billboard, Daisy, City of Dreamers, Blind Date, Home for Christmas, The Brighton Mob, Fractured, Further Ed, Court, Tracks, and Tucked, which is starring Jordan Stevens, April Pearson, Steve Aram, and Darren Nesbitt. It is a fantastic movie. But the movie we're here to talk about, which is out now on Curzon Home Cinema and very soon BFI Player, is called Justine. On the Curzon Home Cinema, go seek it out. It's an absolute delight. It's brilliant. Cyan Reese-Williams stars in it, as does Steve Aram again. Tallulah Haddon is amazing. Kirstie Dillon, Sophie Reed, and Xavian Russell. So, Dom, what did you learn? What will our listeners take away from this episode with the fantastic Jamie Patterson?
So, some classic points to take away. Building a good team for multiple projects. Why you have to be proud of all your work and not believing the hype.
Absolutely. We also talk about signing contracts, distribution, funding, where that comes from, directing other people's material, talking to actors, and how casting is crucial. We had so much fun with Jamie. It was a real laugh. And hopefully you'll take lots away from this episode. But mainly how you can direct 16 features in 10 years. And Jamie is proof you can do that and make fantastic award-winning films at the same time. Dom, how are you, buddy? You all right?
Yeah.
Good.
I'm very good. I'm enjoying wearing the same blue top as you. Apparently, it's a sort of a filmmaker's long sleeve special.
For those of you who are listening as a podcast, which this is, you have no idea we're both wearing a blue top. And actually, it's almost identical. They'd never have known, Dom, that we have worn the same outfit today.
Yep. And our lockdown haircuts are looking remarkably similar as well.
Mine's slightly longer than yours, but yes, it's not looking good. So look, thank you so much for listening to our latest episodes. Jennifer Sheridan last week talking about Rose, a love story. Oh, it was a delight, and she was a delight. And thank you those who have watched her movie this week. I hope you really enjoyed it. If you do, remember to go and tell her that on her @Filmmania Twitter account. But thank you for listening last week. This Thursday, remember, we've got Clubhouse. It's our regular event that Android people will be able to join from today,
oh,
I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, finally.
So Clubhouse is at 7 p.m. every Thursday. We do a filmmakers podcast chat and we'll have a different topic and you can come and ask questions and it's very open forum and it's brilliant. But I believe I read that today that it's now opening for Android users. So it's not just iPhone. So come join us Thursday, wherever you are in the world, 7 p.m. UK time, 11 p.m. Pacific. Anyway, so that's that.
Who knows?
But that means Dom can join us for the first time, ever. Which would be amazing. Because he is part of this team, and it has been sad to not have you on there.
Oh, wear my blue top.
Yeah, wear blue top, because even more so on Clubhouse, no one can see you at all. It's not even like we've got a Zoom where we can see each other. Clubhouse is literally like a conference call.
Oh, boo.
But yes, blue tops are recommended. And our Patreon is up and running and flying out the door. We'll be having a new mini episode out this week if you want to come support the podcast, but more importantly get all the really cool goodies that you get with Patreon, then do go to our patreon.com/filmmakerspodcast and join up. There's some really cool juicy bonus content for you, including I'm just going to read a couple of these out: 2 monthly minisodes, early access to the podcast, and up to 20% off of our merchandise. But anyway, that is us. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode with myself and the amazing Dom Lenoir.
Yeah!
Yay! And myself and the fantastic Jamie Patterson. Sit back, relax, get a pen and paper ready. And that's just to write down some of the jokes and the laughs that we have, but then also to write down some of the information you will massively glean from this episode. Jamie, you're a star, and I can't wait to see what you do next. Enjoy, everyone. Jamie Patterson, it's an absolute delight to have you finally with the earphones and the mic on the Filmmakers Podcast.
I'm very excited to be here. This is glorious.
This is glorious. I'm over the moon. How are you doing? How are you coping?
I'm all right. Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, by lockdown 3, I've learned from it. You know, it's not as good as the first one.
No, it never had the same.
It's just, I look at the lockdowns as like, do you like the Mighty Ducks franchise is a great way of looking at it.
Oh, Emilio Estevez smashing it every time.
Mighty Ducks 1 was, okay, it was new. It was like, oh, we're not got all this time, jazzy, whatever. By the time we got to like Mighty Ducks 2, I was like, okay, I'll give it a go, but it's not, you know, whatever. Mighty Ducks 3, I was like, whew. It's a slog getting through this one.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a slog.
Let's put that idea on ice.
Yeah, there we go.
There we go. Very good, Dom. Very good. Just puck it all.
Puck it.
Hence why I've grown this beard, Jamie. This is my third lockdown beard. Well, it's my growth of the third lockdown, and I've never grown it this long, ever.
It's lush. I still can't grow a beard.
Can you not?
This is about 4 weeks worth, so... I get the wispy little pubes on the chin. That's all I've got.
Really?
It's sad that our viewers can't see this.
It's
really,
such a shame. Such a shame.
Dom, you feel left out because you're in between. You've neither got a beard nor you haven't.
Well, yeah, I feel like I'm just, you know, I've just got a good mid-range beard.
That's a lovely, what would we call that, stubble? What is that? Like, how long is that taking?
It's well past a stubble. It's a light adventurer's beard. I think I'd like to.
It's a gentleman's adventurer beard.
You look like a sort of like a rock climber. That's the vibe I'm getting from you.
Yeah, I used to enjoy rock climbing.
There you go.
That's a great.
See,
here we go.
There you go. Look what we've actually covered some amazing topics already, everyone, and a bit of bouldering. You live in Brighton. I love Brighton. Every time I've been there, I've had a great time. I filmed a lot down there, and it's just a vibrant, exciting, wonderful place. Have you lived there for a long time? Because you've always made films down there. Pretty much every one of your films is set down Brighton way.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, born and raised.
Were you? Oh.
So, yeah, it's always been home. It's kind of always been just what I've known. It provides everything for filming. Like, it's just got it all. Like, I think the fourth film I made was this movie called City of Dreamers, which was like my love letter at the time to Brighton. And even though I've shot so many films in Brighton, you can always find a different angle to approach it. There's so many different sides. There's like the touristy side. There's the sort of darker side. There's the vibrant, colourful side. There's the edgy side. And it's kind of, it's just a city that keeps on giving.
Mm. When I first watched the movie, Justine, I was like, I thought this was London. I was 100% sure.
Really?
I thought, oh, this is London. And then suddenly went to the seat. I thought, when did they get on the train? Oh, it's all set in Brighton. And I really love that. I love that you Not that you were aiming to fool me or anything, but I just like the fact that it
that was the whole point.
Yeah, just to fool you.
That was it.
We're going to get those Londoners. Little do they know, there isn't a sea in London.
The Thames can look that bad. Joke's on you, idiots. But, you know, Brighton's an amazing place to film. And is because you film so much down there, is it easy now to speak to the council to get permissions? Because, you know, you're still making low-budget films in terms of it's not your mega Harry Potter world where they come in and take over. It's still you, you know, small crew, camera. Do you still get permissions? Is it easier now to do all that, to move everything forward?
No, I wouldn't say it's easier. I think any sort of interior locations, fine, so clubs, cafes, bar, all of that stuff. I think anytime we ever shoot on the streets in Brighton, it's always been a bit tricky. And it's always been something I've sort of just avoided in parts, just because it worked a lot easier. It works a lot easier. We have a small crew, we have a small setup, and you know, the process, I remember early doors when we were trying to do some bits of Bob's, you know, it just wasn't feasible on the budgets that we had. And there was a slight lack of support, I think, in like them going out of their way to help indie filmmakers. Mm-hmm. You know, now there's a lot more stuff getting shot here, but, you know, I'm talking, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And we just felt like, you know, anything that we thought, you know, if we were doing fight scenes or anything like that, we would contact the police and we'd be like, look, hey, if they hear shout and all of this stuff, we're shooting a movie. And we would let all local residents know. So there's, for instance, the scene in, there's loads of stuff outside in Justine. And we would just let everyone know in the area that we were filming. And we always do it that, you know, we try not to put other people out. So, you know, if a car's coming or people need to walk, we'll cut, we'll wait till they leave, we'll come back. We'll try not to like piss anyone off. But generally, you know, in Brighton, people are quite nice about it and they stop and watch and they're interested.
That's really good. You've never had trouble then? You never had trouble from the council coming over going, you can't film here? You've never had trouble from residents really, you know, being funny or kids
or
being annoying?
Funny individuals coming along, sort of, you know, not moving because it's...
Oh, yeah,
know, right,
yeah.
Not
I mean,
move.
Not so much. I did a movie. It was two things come to mind. We did this film Fractured, which we did for like 14 grand, which is like one of my... I think it's a really cool little horror. It's like an 8-minute horror. It's, and we shot all of the driving stuff we shot up on the dike. So we were going back and forth there. And I remember like, for some reason we bought loads of high vis jackets for the crew, but we didn't check them before we opened them and they were all extra small. So they were like crop tops. So like, we just looked weird as fuck.
Yeah,
And on two occasions we had the police come by and stop. But thankfully both times they were Skins fans and my missus is in Skins or was in Skins. And they were just like, oh, you're a girl from Skin. They had a chat, they took a picture, and they were like, good luck with it, and left. We did once stick a generator basically in someone's driveway when we were shooting the scene in a forest, and they called the cops as well. And we're like, they did not, and it was the like huge, loud generator, and we just put it in their drive.
Oh, wow. No wonder. They'd be like, listen, I can't get my car out. Not anymore. Yeah. This is really fucking loud.
Yeah.
Rude. Yeah.
But again, the cops were cool. They turned up. Again, fans of Skins. Like, yo, yeah, we'll only be half hour. We knocked on a door. Oh, really sorry. Here's a biscuit, something like that. And we got away with it. So the worst I've ever, any location I've ever shot and it's been the worst was Venice. So I did a film called Making Tracks, which was like, we had a crew of 7 and we were in Rome, we were in Nice, we were in Paris, we were in Venice. And you know what Venice is like? You stick it, you know, it's busy. It's so busy. And you know, as soon as you stop with a camera, every dickhead in the world wants to look in it. Hi, how you doing? Hi. you know, when you're like, hi, it's really funny. It's really, and it just goes on nonstop for your
it's
whole
never
day.
Funny.
And you're like, it's never funny. I can't get the shots. I don't know what we're going to do here. That was definitely the hardest.
There's definitely like a huge added pressure when you're shooting abroad. I did a film in like Germany a while ago, and when there's a language barrier, especially in like remote locations, and it's not like somewhere where you know you haven't really got any angle to film. You're the kind of the stranger sort of there with the film crew interrupting people. It's quite a difficult thing. You know, did you have like a fixer?
No, I had, so my producer, Finn, who we did 2 movies back to back. We did this film called Tucked, and then we had a week and a half off, and then we went off and did Making Tracks, or Tracks, where depending where you watch it. And he would kind of always be a day ahead of us. So he would go and shoot. So it was a crazy one because we didn't have any location sorted. All our supporting cast would cast on the day. We'd be in a pub and just be like, hey, do you want to come and do a scene in the movie? And it kind of it added to that sort of authentic feel. But I remember, I mean, the worst thing I think we did, we was in Milan, and there's a sequence in the movie where our lead is, he's running for a train. He's late for a train. And he is, we're at Milan station, absolutely heaving, boiling hot day. We haven't got walkies or anything like that. So like the main team's over there, and it's me, Chris, our DOP, and our sound girl, Kirsty. And we're kind of like, okay, Chris, he's covered in sweats. So we put fake sweat on him. So all you got to do is run as fast as you can towards that station on my call, get everything rolling. And then we kind of see like my team like waving their hands. I'm realizing I'm waving on a podcast and like people can't see that, but waving the hands.
We can add some sound effects.
Going, and I feel like they're telling me to hurry up. So I'm like, okay, fine, we'll do it. Fine. So action. And Chris starts running as fast as he can towards this place. And then it kind of all happened in slow motion, but you saw this one like armed guard appear from behind a cafe. And when I say armed guard, he was like 7 foot tall, like huge machine gun, like, and like the beret, everything.
Wow.
I don't know why he's wearing a beret, but he had a beret on.
Dolph Lundgren kind of look.
Proper Dolph Lundgren vibes. Yeah. Like just a mean bastard. Like you wouldn't want to upset him. And I've gone, oh, that's interesting. And then it sort of stopped that Chris is running with a huge backpack on, sweating, with a woman next to him with a box with loads of wires coming out of it. And we've all sort of gone, shit in hell. It looks like he's got a, oh my God.
And you haven't told anyone.
Didn't think, I can't shout, because if I shout, it's going to look worse.
Bomb.
All my team is at this point fucked off. Everyone's gone separate ways, so we look even dodgier. And then I'm like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. And then I see behind the cafe, which I didn't see before, is a tank with four other armed guards. It's like on high alert. And this guy, and he's fucking running. I remember we all sort of just went, you just don't know what to do. Didn't expect it. And he sort of, thankfully, he's running towards him and he sees the guard. And he just, again, this could have backfired so much, but he just immediately turned and ran away just in a completely different direction. And we're like, oh my God, why? He's going to shoot you in the back. Like, what's going on? Like, and it's just, then
another. That's a legendary response.
Yeah. Like, oh, he's going to shoot you in the back. That's the response.
And we were just like, and everyone just went their separate ways. And we were just.
So
like,
what happened then? He just, no one ever.
He didn't give a fuck. The guard did not give a fuck. It's like, oh, okay. But it's just, you kind of think, another guard, is it like.
Yeah, no, you've got to be so careful, haven't you? That's a huge lesson, isn't it? Like, it's like, Jesus Christ, I mean, someone gets shot, it's over, isn't it?
Don't run through bombs.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if I'd recover from that. Yeah, my career would go right down the can.
It's a tough one, isn't it? It really is. Wow. It's so important to, like, at least sort of recce things like that. I love the story, though. What amazing story.
Yeah, it's one of those stories that, it's funny now, but, I mean, at the time, I remember just going, and it happened.
Terror. Yeah. Absolute terror.
Numerous times when we're just like, I remember there was a scene where we were on a subway in Paris, and this guy got on playing, like, what's that thing called? I know you can't.
An accordion?
That's
life
it.
Jacket?
An accordion.
It's like you were putting a jacket on, but I guessed accordion.
He was playing an accordion, like proper French dude, right geez. And we were like, oh, we've got to have this scene where they're dancing. This is brilliant. He didn't speak a word of English. So we managed to get him, I don't know where he was going, but we got him off the train. And then he just played on the subway next. And we were just dancing. We were like, brilliant. Thanks so much. We gave him 20 euros. Oh, no, that wasn't any. No, he wanted a lot more. He was like, basically, let's like clean out your pocket. Like, I want everything you've got. If you just made me get off this, I'm in a film. What am I doing? And we were like, you were a really nice Frenchman a minute ago. Now you're a really angry Frenchman. What have we done? So we had to give him like, so we basically got robbed.
Yeah, you've got robbed by the accordion man.
Yeah, but it's a great scene. So it's worth it.
Yeah, well, that's totally worth it.
That's a lesson in negotiation there. always have your contracts done up front.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Hey, Mr. Accordion Man.
We just didn't speak. We didn't really speak. Our DP spoke a little bit of French, but it's my comfort zone in Brighton. You put me in front anywhere like that. Put me in London. I'm not in my comfort zone in London. You know, we did a movie called The Kindred, which did 8 days in London, in Trellick Towers, in and around Trellick Towers. And it's different vibes, different, you know, it's just, it's different experience.
I totally agree with you. Knowing your own space, your area, which is why I love, before I go filming anywhere, is to spend as much time as I can in those locations. Because you then you sort of see every nook and cranny and you just feel it. For you, shooting in Brighton, it's like, yeah, you know where all the cool areas are. You know where the best bits, you know what the best sunrise times are. You know it. And that must be a great advantage, you know, especially the stuff you shot on the beach in Justine, which by the sounds of it was freezing cold, and I imagine it was, or just lit by the fire, right? So therefore it's really difficult to shoot scenes like that anyway, but at least you knew, you know, it looked amazing and you knew what you were putting yourself through.
Yeah, that, I remember that was our last that went, and it was one of those things where things kept going a bit tits up with it, but it worked for it, if that made sense. Yeah, the weather wasn't glorious, but that kind of added to the color palette of the movie.
Yeah,
I remember
it did,
in the script they're supposed to peel off their clothes and run into the sea and play in the sea. We got there and we're like, the sea's fucking 7 miles away.
Yeah, it's like someone running across the beach. Like, they're never going to get there.
And so we were like, all right, and we're trying to stick up a drone and it's windy and we're just like, fuck it, we're losing light, because you know what that's like when you're like,
oh God,
we've got 20 minutes to get it or we're fucked. Mm. And we managed to get it, and then we was going for it, and then realized they were just running and they couldn't hear us shout cut. So they are literally miles out. Then they're rolling around. I've cut ages ago. They're rolling around on the floor kissing. I'm like, so now I've got to run there. I'll send you a picture. I was dressed like a right twat. I was in
I've seen it. Yeah. Go on, tell everyone what you were wearing.
I was wearing brand new white high tops and this sort of 80s bowling jacket, tight jeans, like I'd never been on a beach in my life. And I'm running. And it's one of those things as well, when you know when you run really fast for like 5 seconds and then you're like,
I've done that. Oh my God,
I can't. I'm going to have to now just stop completely.
Stop everything. Stop my life.
Cardio level zero.
Yeah. So I'm like having to get there in these like staggered, they're still rolling around, they can't hear us. But it was one of those things where it's that sequence is probably my favorite sequence, I think, in that movie. It's just it was worth it.
Well, let's jump back a little bit, because you know it's an amazing sort of career. You're only 34, right? Is that
34?
34,
yeah.
34, so it means you made your first feature at like 22, 23, 24, so ish. Yeah, so let's talk.
When was I think I shot it when I was 19, I think I shot my first feature.
Look at that, even better. So let's talk through that, because you've been a production assistant on other things. Your first feature, as far as I can tell, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is Swimming in Circles.
Yeah,
right. Is that the one you shot when you were 19? Okay, cool. So let's talk through why you wanted to become a filmmaker and how you made that happen, and why did you make a feature film at 19?
So obviously, like, my childhood was films, basically. You know, I remember, like, all I would do is watch films, pretty much. They're some of my favorite memories as a kid. Non-stop.
The Mighty Ducks on non-stop loop.
Yeah. You know, Goonies.
Only 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Mighty Ducks 3.
All of it, and then just go back. Sometimes I'd watch the second one first, and I'd watch the third and go back to the
first.
Just
like The Godfather, I'd fuck it up.
Really, you know what I mean? I'm telling you, Mighty Ducks first one is better than The Godfather. Put it out there.
That's a quote from a t-shirt.
Quote, yeah. And I'd kind of, you know, and this wasn't just for my child, you know, even when I was 18, I wasn't going out on a Saturday night with my friends getting pissed. I was, a highlight of my week was going to the Video Box where I'd worked as well. I worked in a video
love
shop
it.
And I would rent, me and my mum and my dad would watch a movie. And, you know, I still remember one of the best days of my life was when I came home from school on like a Thursday and there was a Video Box cassette on the table. And I was like, oh my God, a midweek film. Opened it, Lethal Weapon 4. What a day. What a day in the Patterson household that was. And it was great. That was kind of my, and I was just, I loved film. James Bond was my thing. You know, I would watch Bond movies nonstop, Live and Let Die. I'd watch it and then watch it again. And I would just, I'd get lost in these worlds and these films. And then kind of about, I guess, 13, 14, when I kind of figured out a bit more what a director was, a storyteller, you know, my thing, when I was never very good in school, in my feedback would always be like, he's got a lot of ideas. He can never
apply himself.
Just writes a story. And it starts off as one thing and then it's about three or four other things. And I think still to this day, I'm very much like that with, I have about 10 or so projects on at the same time. Cause you know how it is, you never know what's going to go next.
That's so true, mate. And I think it's so important, because like, just to jump in there a little bit, when I first started trying to make my own movies, all I did was have one project and I put all my effort into that for so many years, and then it hurt so much when it fell apart. Now, not a chance. Now I've got the 10 that could go, you know, within the next couple of months. And it's so important, I feel, to do that, because otherwise it does hurt. You do get lost, and hope you're the same. You can bounce between projects that way, and it's easier to sort of feel in some sort of control, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally. I think, you know, you could develop, I was developing like this action female-led Die Hard movie, American movie that I was co-writing with a guy called Christian J. Hearn, who wrote Fractured and wrote The Kindred. And it was cool as fuck, female. It was just a kick-ass action movie, but it was about cops and it was in America. And right now that's just not a movie anyone's wanting to look at. And it was like, we'd spent however long writing it. And it, you know, the movie isn't, it's not necessarily trying to say anything as a movie. It is just a kick-ass action film. But it's not a movie that now is going to be made. And I completely understand why. It was also, you know, it was written with good intentions and stuff like that. But, you know, the work, everything's changing so fast. Within this industry, it changes so fast. What you can do, what you can't do, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, all of that stuff. And, you know, the conversations being had now are conversations that are long overdue. And, you know, it's totally right. But if I had have only had that project, I would have been devastated because I didn't have anything to fall back on. So yeah, there's always, and there's TV, and then I want to do some theater, and it's just whatever. Because then, if you know what it's like, you're in a meeting and you're there to pitch a horror, and within the first 10 seconds they're like, we're not looking for a horror,
yeah,
we're looking for Mighty Ducks 5.
Yeah,
yes, so, yeah, exactly.
Well, I got it, a British Mighty Ducks reboot or whatever. So I think it's really good to have numerous projects. So yeah, when I was, and that's the thing, I would always watch, I didn't have like one genre I'd watch. I would watch action movies or horror films or romance. Like, I loved, the only things I didn't really like was sci-fi and westerns. Like, I don't like Star Wars, sue me, it's too much going on. Too many characters, too many planets. I don't know where the hell I am.
Jamie, I'm with you. Look, there's a lot of people going to be throwing shit at the moment.
Vehemently disagree with
you. I'm going to tell you my Star Wars story, right, real quick. When I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to watch Star Wars or whatever, and all my friends had the toys. I was like, what are these? Oh, they're Star Wars. I was like, oh, cool, cool, cool. So for Christmas that year, I said, I'd like a Luke Skywalker figure. And at Christmas Day, there it was, Luke Skywalker figure. I thought, oh my God, right, I'm going to get into Star Wars. This is it. This is my thing. That was the day some guy came around. I still really don't know who he was. And he died in the chair where all my sort of the presents were put on chairs and moved around in this room. And he had heart attack. The ambulance wouldn't come for ages. I got shipped upstairs. All the presents got chucked in a bag. And then when he'd eventually come round, because apparently they did, his heart stopped, he died, he was out cold for like hours. I don't know how that works, you know, realistically, but anyway, that's what I got told.
Do you think Luke killed him?
Well, it maybe, because then he pissed off, because when they came back to go, right, here's, you know, we put them all in bags, here they are, I went through them, Luke was nowhere to be found. All that was left,
oh, there we go, it was the Force.
All that was left was the lightsaber. From that day on, I went, fuck you, Star Wars. Fuck you. So I'm with you, Jamie.
I would have looked at that as a spiritual intervention.
That's why we're different.
My favourite part of that is some guy turned up at your house and died.
I think it was Santa Claus. I think it was Santa Claus.
I think this is all just a big, this is just a big cover-up for Giles' first murder.
Yeah. He died. Something happened.
My first one. I like that. Just my first one. It wasn't just like a murder.
He's done many since then.
I think it was a friend of some grandpa's or whatever who was round. And then, yeah, just had literally died in the chair. How horrendous. Killed that Christmas for me. So anyway, so I'm the same with you. So you didn't like sci-fi, but oh, westerns. I was never keen on westerns either. But you, there's so many other genres we can love and fall in love with than you had. So did you just, like, say, pick up a camera early on? Is that also what you did? Or how did you actually start going, I'm actually going to make a proper film here?
Yeah, well, I think, like, most people, like, sort of my generation, you know, I was watching stuff like Kevin Smith's Clerks or Rodriguez's El Mariachi or, you know, Reservoir Dogs, any of these movies. And I certainly remember seeing Clerks and going, I think I can do something similar to that. Because still, I've never made a short film. I've still never made a short film. I'm not sure I would know,
that's really interesting,
how to make a short film. I think making a short film is harder because I think
I agree.
Yeah, three-act structure in 5 minutes. And
it's really hard to get a really good short. It's really, really hard. No question
about it. It's totally different. It's different to, you know, everything you sort of grow up on watching features. Like, you don't grow up watching shorts. it is its own kind of structure. You have to sort of learn it from the ground up.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And it was just, it was also, it was one of those things where I was like, well, I've seen enough movies. I think I now just know how to do it. All I've got to do is write something that's, I should say as well, I did go to Brighton Film School at the time. So I did like, but it was a 10-week course, 10 Wednesdays. I've missed the first one because I got pissed the night before. Really annoying because it was a birthday present and mum was fuming. It's like, you know, you know when you're like, I got a phone call being like, where are you? I was like, who are you? And like, Brighton Film School. It's like, oh shit, I thought it started next week. So I missed the first one. And then it was different then. The film school is incredible now. But at the time it was like, we had one sort of mini DV camera between 20 of us. Like, you know, the oldest editing software out there. It was very old fashioned in the way it was put together. But I met some great people there and had, you know, met some good friends and kind of just, I didn't necessarily learn anything there that you can't learn in a book. Like my best book I ever got was An Idiot's Guide to Independent Filmmaking, which I think you can buy now for a penny on Amazon. And it was brilliant. It just had everything in it that you'd need to know to make a movie, basically. And then I just decided, the week where I left film school, I got offered, I was a runner on this movie called Dummy, which Aaron Taylor Johnson was in, and like no one saw it. I actually think the studio, I think when he did Kick-Ass, or it might have been Nowhere Boy, that movie hadn't been released. And I think the studio bought it and shelved it because they were like,
it can happen. It's horrible.
They didn't. It's not a bad movie, but it's like, it's something you think you'd see on probably ITV. You know, it's almost like an ITV or Channel 5. Like, it's just like, it's not his Kick-Ass.
No, and if he hadn't broken out, if he hadn't got Kick-Ass or Nowhere Boy, they probably would have released it and it would have come out and been fine. And yeah.
he got his arse out in it as well. And I think they were like, oh God, we're not sure.
I feel like he's done that in other stuff.
I feel like he's got it out. Maybe they wanted the exclusive arse shot. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe his arse has improved over years and he wasn't happy with it at the time.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Arse wranglers.
I did that. And then, you know, I was writing Swimming in Circles, trying to get it right. But then just doing what I was a clapper loader. I was a third AD, a second AD. I was a first.
How did you just jump in on that, Jamie? How did you get those jobs? How did you, was it people you knew? You know, for the people listening, if they haven't been on set, how did you get on set?
So when I got the job as a runner on Dummy, I was good friends with the line producer on that film. And she went on to do another and like so many things in this industry, it's like if you get on with someone and you do a good job, they want you on the next thing.
100%.
It just goes on. Yeah. So probably off of that one job I did on Dummy, I think I got 6 jobs. Now, granted, none of these paid. So it was that
you've
I didn't
got to
get
start
it.
Somewhere.
But, you know, yeah, I was living at home with my folks, and like I remember when I went, the next project I did was a weird as fuck project. So it was the Bible project, right?
Yeah, the big TV one.
No, didn't do that one. Okay. The shitty one that no one saw. That's what I was. It was an odd one because I remember I was a production assistant on it, and I got it through the line producer of Dummy as well. And it was this company in America had given shitloads of money to do these 20-minute shorts of sections of the Bible. And they were spending like 1.6 million or something on these big things. And I remember I was excited because we were shooting on a red, and the red was really hip and hot.
The red one, yeah, the new one.
Yeah, yeah, everyone was like, yeah. Oh, cool, the red. Yeah. And it shot in Morocco, and we was at Atlas Studios, which is where they'd done Kingdom of Heaven, that terrible Orlando Bloom movie. I remember I was telling everyone I was staying in Orlando Bloom's room because that's what I'd been told. Absolute lie. I was staying in his mum's room. Like, for some reason, Orlando's doing mum went with him.
I hope she wasn't there.
Me and her, if we go way back.
Though, to be fair, if she looks like Orlando in any way, shape, or form, she's not going to be
He's got
back.
Better with age as well. He's looking great these days.
His latest film. He looked fantastic, innit? Retaliation, okay. Yeah. I think the directors are going to come on. Shamassian Brothers said they'd come on the app, on the pod, and have a chat. So, yeah, so it looks great. That film looks fantastic. I can't wait to see it just because, you know, it's Orlando. But anyway, so you're not staying in Orlando's room because that would have been great.
Yeah. And I remember, like, I'd never shot anything at a studio before on these big sets. And I didn't really know what to expect. But I remember I got there, I think it was day two, and they went, okay, yeah, we've got a job for you, Jamie. I was like, oh, okay, great. And they introduced me to this camel, and I was like,
he had the hump.
Yeah, Humphrey. I tell you what, grumpy bastards camel. I'd never seen a camel. I'd never hung out with a camel.
No, they're not friends to humans.
They're not.
Why would there be?
They just went, your job is to look after this camel for
an hour. Oh my God.
And I was like, what do you mean look after a camel?
I hope you put that on your CV as camel herder.
Camel looker after, camel wrangler.
Like, what is it? And also, we were shooting just outside where the studio, and it was baking hot. And I didn't have I was dressed like a dickhead. I didn't have an umbrella. I was just burning, and I was just sitting on a stone with a camel for just hours. And I was
camels
just like,
have got a solution for that. You just got to put it in the hump.
what do you do with a camel? Like, what do you do? I was like, this is, well, I was sweating.
You can't even play with them.
Can't play with them. Can't do anything. It just spits at you. And you're like, they did the first day, didn't use it once. Camel wasn't in it. So I'm like, here's the camel bat. Just spent 8 hours with it.
Did you get to ride it?
Didn't get to ride it. Did nothing with a camel. Didn't even want to touch it, really. I just didn't want it to eat me. And then, so we go out first night. Second day, same thing. I was like, I'm looking after this camel. They never used it. And I was like, this is ridiculous. At the end of it, I'm like, it was my birthday the next day. And I was like, I'm not looking after that. I'm going to come in tomorrow and I'm going to say, I'm not looking after the camel because they're never using the camel. Camel doesn't like me. This isn't what I want to do. That night we went out, ate something, got the worst food poisoning I've ever had in my life.
Oh no.
So I didn't go to set the next day to look after the camel because I didn't leave the bedroom for the next 2 days. And then by the time I'd finally got back to set, they pretty much shot it all. So I was like, great.
Not the camel, I hope.
so that was like, I'd done that. And yeah, I was right in swimming in circles. I was, like I said, doing clapperloader, doing whatever I can based on sort of people recommending me. And then I put my girlfriend at the time in swimming in circles. She was an actress, is an actress. And then I did like just a local casting thing. I shot in my mate's house. My mate Ted was doing sound. We bought like a $12.99 mic from Maplin, put it on the end of a mop, gaffered it on.
Love that. Love
straight
that.
Into the camera. No faffing about. I shot it. I'd never done that before. I'm not really a camera dude, but I shot it. We shot the whole movie in 4 days. It was kind of this black and white inspired by Clerks again. And it was just about an unlikely friendship. I think if you look at that and you look at a lot of my films, like Tucked or whatever, I'm fascinated by it. Like this idea of unlikely friendships and bromances and romances and all of this stuff.
I agree, yeah.
And it was, you know, it took me 3 years to, I think 2 and a bit years to edit it because I made that, it was the first feature I'd ever edited. I edited it all on a laptop, which then my laptop, I remember at Christmas, my laptop blew up. And I didn't
I'm
back.
Not surprised.
I just had the footage.
Oh, no.
It was like I think I paid £600 for it, Toshiba laptop. It was like it was huge.
Just not good for editing on. Really just
that
doesn't
sounds
like
an,
it.
Sounds like an aeroplane.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it just went kaput. And I remember I had to work another couple of jobs. I've had some weird jobs. I did silver service. I drove a train around Lapland. I was a carpet fitter, whatever I could. To get money to buy another laptop.
Drove a train round Lapland.
Best job I ever had. I say Lapland. It was Lapland in Earls Court. But still, it was Lapland. It was still Lapland in my head. Honestly, it was the best job. I drove Tamir Hassan round. Do you know him, the actor?
Yeah, Tamir Hassan,
is that?
I think it's Tamir Hassan. I think that's how you pronounce it.
I drove him around my train right when he was doing The Business as well. So he was like, The Business is like my parents' favourite
film. It's a brilliant film. It's a really good, well-made film, that. Very good. Go on, Dom.
No, I was just going to say, so when you're making this feature, this is like your sort of the first time you sort of got behind the camera, you've done the sound yourself. Like, what actual struggles did you come across in the post-production period? Because I imagine that you may have like had some shots that were missing, or you've had to go through the ADR process. You know, was it straightforward? Did it sort of turn out all right? Or was it like a real, like, shocking learning experience?
Oh, it turned out awful. Like, it's terrible. It's such a bad movie. It's got, what I like about it is, there's snippets of it which I've used in later, like movies I've done later on, shots or ideas or something. But I think it's a complete mess of a movie. But you know what? It is a finished feature film, and I think that was so much of what filmmaking is problem solving. But it's also, you make mistakes on every film you do. You make mistakes. The key thing is you try not to make the same mistake twice. You just make new ones. But you're always making mistakes. So it was such a, for me, it was such a great learning process to be like, I've made this film, it's shit, but I did it. Now, if I could just get a bit more money, if I could, yeah, I need to develop myself as a writer, I need to, you know, a bit more production value. And I kind of, you know, that had a budget of £100 for that movie.
Wow.
So it was low.
And did you release
how,
it?
How much of that was the mop?
Yeah, exactly. got the best mop.
How good was this mop?
The mop was my mum's mop. She weren't happy about that. She never used it, to be fair. But it was one of those things, you know, when it'd been under the stairs for years. She'd never used it. I take it out.
As soon as you wanted it.
Yeah. Yep. I take it out, break it, granted.
Of course.
And use it. And then all of a sudden, it's like she mops every day. And it's like, where's my mop? I was like...
She turns into Mrs. Mop. Exactly. Going, where is it? I need it now. Absolutely shocked. Fuming. No fun. But so did you get that film released at all? Did you push it out?
We premiered it above the Marwood pub. I remember it was like we had like 70 people come along.
Wow. And it was cool. Like,
that's a good turnout.
Yeah, it was all friends, all fans. I've been really lucky. I've always had like a really good, loyal, amazing bunch of friends and family who've always, from that film to anything I've done, have always supported it, have always watched it.
That's really cool. That's great.
And I remember that night we did, it came out briefly. I think we put it on YouTube for free now, just because I like having the trailer's definitely on YouTube. I think it was on Vimeo on demand for a bit. I think when we did something with that, now it's a movie, like I would show it to anyone who asked, but it's not necessarily a movie. If you put my name into Google that I want to be like, oh, this is the movie he did. But I think it's important that I acknowledge it and I own it. And I'm still very proud of it. I tried just as hard on that film as I have on my last film. It's just I'm a better filmmaker now, hopefully.
I had a similar thing. Like, I made a couple of features that were sub £5,000 for them. And some people are like, oh, yeah, you shouldn't talk about them. You can't claim them as a feature. It's like, well, you've gone through the process of making a feature. You've delivered it. It's, out on DVD or, some kind of streaming service somewhere. Whether it's good or not, whether it represents where you are, like it shows that you've gone through that process and you're still doing stuff. So I think it's it's something you should own.
I totally agree. Totally agree. So from there, you were like, I want to carry on this. You made this for 100 quid and a broken mop. What? How did you then go?
I want to see the sequel, like, but involving the mop. I think it could make a great character. The mop.
Great.
What about? I'm just going to pitch
Come on,
this.
Please,
Mighty
pitch.
Ducks 4 involving, a guy who can't afford,
an ice
hockey stick.
His own
so he gets
stick,
a,
yep.
he gets the mock. He tapes it together. He uses a microphone on the end to get the little hook to score. And he becomes the best duck ever.
We'll make it for £100. It's just, yeah.
I'm in.
We're all in.
Oh God! But you, but then you went on to your second feature almost straight away. I mean, like I say, it took you 2 years to edit that, but as soon as you'd got it out and you'd watched it and you got people to watch it, and that still inspired you to go, no, this is what I want to do. And Confession and Billboard almost seemed to be in the same year, and Daisy as well. It's like you just went bam, 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 bam. Was this just in your conscious to say, I'm just, I'm living at home, I can do this. I'm just going to keep making movies. What was your thinking process behind that?
Yeah, I think I was very, I knew I had an opportunity when I was sort of in my early 20s where I wasn't paying rent. I was paying a little bit of rent, but I was working. I think I was doing a data inputting job at the time as well.
I love all your jobs. There's so many amazing jobs you've had.
Did you go through agencies? Is that what it is?
Special job requirements needed. Camel wrangler.
Camel wrangler and train driver.
Oh, that train driver. What a job. I would just do whatever came up that allowed me to still do my films. You know what I mean? The data inputting was like, I was never contracted on any of these jobs. So if something in my head, I was like, when Bond comes, I could just leave this and do my Bond movie. When we premiered Swimming in Circles, that night I got given £3,000 to make Billboard by like friends and family. They were just like, oh, she's so good. Have you got an idea for another one? And I'd already, like anyone says, when you premiere a movie, really, you should have the next movie good to go. Or like, I always try and have, like Justine's out now, but I've got two more features in post because it's important. You never know how a film's going to perform. But I got given £3,000 to make Billboard, and that was kind of my dark, that's why I started to explore a little bit more dark comedy. It's this weird thing of this couple that have a one night stand and accidentally end up killing her abusive ex-boyfriend, and then they have to cut the body up and bury it and get away with the, those sort of, you've seen it a lot in American cinema, American indies. This was kind of, you'd see this movie a lot. I was like, I'll have a go at that. And I did that for 3,000. Same thing. I think we shot that in 7 or 8 days. And then I did Confession, which was all in a flat again, two actors, all about sort of the decline of their relationship as they move into a new flat. Made that for £500. And was just, I at this point, I wasn't editing anymore. So after Swimming in Circles.
David Fricker, who's been, like, we've worked with him loads, right? And his name's been bouncing around for a long time in my world as well. So that's great that you've got that collaboration with someone.
Yeah, and he's great. He's just, he's brilliant at what he does. We have a great working relationship. And it was just, for me, it was quickly, I didn't have the patience to be an editor. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's not easy.
It's, yeah.
But what I think is good is that you've learned to do it. You, like I did, I had to, it was horrible, painful. I was doing some corporate thing and I had to teach myself to do it because I'd paid so little on the job. I was like, well, I can't, you know, I'm producing this. I can't afford to bring an editor in. I'll learn. And it was the longest, most painful thing. But I'm so glad I did now. Now I can edit. But I understand. I think it's made me a better filmmaker because you understand your transition shots. You understand how it's going to look in the edit. You're constantly thinking about it.
Corporate editing is extremely soul destroying as well. I had to make a conscious decision just to, you know, unless there was like a really interesting subject matter, just walk away from corporate editing.
Yeah, it's brutal. I haven't done a few in a while, but I remember I did some shockers. The best thing I ever did, I did something for the RSPCA. I did the Staffy Bulldog campaign.
Oh, that was a great campaign. I love that.
It was a cool campaign, but I tell you what, the dogs had bigger teams than any actor I've ever worked with. They had like two agents, a manager, and then there's like, they can only work for 20 minutes before they want. And it totally makes sense, but like, these dogs were divas. I mean, they were glorious. They delivered.
Like my dog Riley. You know what I mean? I'm the set. Like, in fact, I need to get my an agent for my dog so she can do the headers.
And there's so much money in it as well. Like, these dogs were caked up. Like, it's
so they had high tops on and everything.
Yeah.
running along the beach. So anyway, we totally jumped off track with that. But yeah, but you, like I say, you learned to edit, and now you brought in another editor, you were saying, and that helped you sort of go, okay, I can do this. So Billboard, Confession, Daisy, you were sort of like understanding your process a lot more and your filmmaking sort of knowledge.
Over 25 years ago, on September 29th, 1998, we watched a brainy girl with curly hair drop everything to follow a guy she only kind of knew all the way to college. And so began Felicity. My name is Juliette Littman, and I'm a Felicity superfan. Join me, Amanda Foreman, who you may know better as Megan, the roommate, and Greg Grunberg, who you may also know as Sean Blunberg, as the three of us revisit our favorite moments from the show and talk to the people who helped shape it. Listen to Dear Felicity, presented by Walmart, on Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Were you also, during this time, were you thinking, like you say, any minute the James Bond will come, or any minute I'll get funding, or any minute I'll... Was it constantly just going, I'll just go do another one, I'll just do another one?
My thought was always, you know, one of these will hit. I'm going to get better as a filmmaker. One of them will hit, and then that'll be it. That'll be my Clerks, my whatever. I'll win Sundance. It's going to be glorious. And that actually happened, I thought that had happened on my fourth film. So after that, I did this film.
You thought you'd won Sundance?
Not Sundance, but I thought it was the first time in my career where I thought, fucking hell, I've made it. I've proper made it here. I did this, I did this film called City of Dreamers, which we made for 11 grand. I think we shot in 9 or 10 days. And it was like, it was my little love letter to Brighton. It was kind of, do you remember that movie Once? Do you ever see Once?
Yeah. It's like that.
Yeah. Very similar vibes. Love that film. All about this girl who kind of comes down to Brighton in the summer, and through music and the vibe and the general scene sort of starts a new life and finds happiness and love and all of this stuff. And it was the first thing I'd done where I felt like, okay, I know how to write an ending of a movie now, because I think that took me a bit of, you know, normally just everyone dies and that's it. Like, it's like, how do you end a movie? It's trying to figure that out. And it just, I felt like I was a better filmmaker was doing it. And I remember we premiered it at Duke of York's. We'd sold that out a couple of days. And then it was the first one we ever did a festival thing with. So we did festivals with it. And Randy, I've got another Orlando Bloom story. He is featuring heavily in this podcast.
He's for the first time ever.
Sponsored by Orlando Bloom. Yeah.
I remember we sort of...
And his mother.
And a mop.
We'd played like a lot of festivals for me. And we'd gone to like Milan Rhode Island, and we'd won at some of these festivals. They weren't big festivals, but for us it was exciting.
Rhode Island's pretty big.
It's brilliant.
It wasn't.
Yeah,
it wasn't great. Actually Rhode Island. It was a festival in Rhode Island.
Is it like when people are like, yeah, I'm in Cannes, and it's like, are you in Cannes or are you in the Cannes Short Film Quarter?
Exactly. That, yes. I remember we'd gone to Madrid International Film Festival. So me and like eight of the cast and crew kind of were there, and it was a big night. They'd spent a lot of money on it. There was like a full dinner. There was free alcohol. Everyone was in suits and stuff like that. And we'd got nominated for best feature film. And I remember we'd all gone out there and we were like, this is cool. We didn't really think we was going to win it. So everyone's like drinking, and then they get to our category. And we was up against Orlando Bloom had this movie called The Good Doctor. I don't know if you remember it. It's like no one really saw it. It's like, he's actually really good in it. It's quite dark. He plays like a doctor who starts drugging this female patient, so she keeps coming back to him because he's obsessed with her. It was like 1.3 million or something budget. So everyone's just expecting his film's going to win it. And then they get to the bit where they do the clips. And that was the bit we were most excited about. The 10-second clip when they say...
Everyone's going to see
this.
Yeah,
everyone's going to see something of it. And there's some really fucking cool people in here.
Yeah.
And they got to our clip and it didn't work. And I was fuming. And I'd already had a few. I was making right old tea. This is ridiculous. Like my investors had come out there as well. He's
representing England.
So everyone's like fuming. Everyone's in such a bad mood. And then we won. They said, and the winner is City of Dreamers. So everyone was like, oh my God, we won. Got up there, did some ridiculous speech. I said something awful. It was terrible. But was just so excited. And I remember I went straight outside and I phoned my parents and I was like, we've just won this. I think this, and my mom was like, oh my, this is it. This is the start. I think you're going to get stuff. And I'm so proud of you. And you felt like, it felt like, oh wow, we've just beat Orlando Bloom. We must, someone's going to offer me a film, right? This must
just
happen.
Just beat Orlando Bloom. Like,
and then
there he is.
And I remember, so then there was the woman there had won, there's this woman there who'd won for best short. She'd done a short film and it had won best short film. And I got chatting to her. And we were flirting a little bit, going back and forth, you know, it's having a little flirt up. Happy as Larry, like both happy.
We've had a drink.
We both won. And I get chatting, so I was like, well, so yeah, what do you do when you're not making shorts? And she was like, oh, I'm a producer on this TV show. I was like, cool, what's the TV show? And she was like, The Mentalist. Do you remember that TV show?
Of course. Oh, yeah, fantastic.
Great show. Great Simon show. Baker, I think, is the lead now.
Simon Baker, yeah.
And she was like, yeah, I produce on this. I'm looking to write and get into it. So I'm like chatting to her, and like we go to this club, we had this wild great night, and then she's like, you should come out to LA. Come to Warner Brothers. Like, I'll introduce you to the writers, producers, and stuff like that. So when you're like 24 or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you've just, I remember also, is it Madeline Zimmer was at this night? Do you remember her? Do you remember, what's she, Californication? She's the one who
Yeah, Californication, punches. The one that punches him in
yeah.
the face.
Yeah, she was there. She won Best Actress and I had a little dance with her. Happy days.
Oh, great. Happy days, indeed.
So I was like, oh my God, I'm going to go to
Top
LA.
Top of the world.
So I had so that's exactly what I did. I came back and I thought, I booked a flight to LA. I stayed with my friend Lucy, who was in a TV show called True Blood out there. And she put me up for like 6 weeks, six and a half weeks for nothing. Absolute legend. When I got there, I remember I was just like, I've come here to basically do The Mentalist in my head. And I'd started spending money like an absolute don, everything on a credit card. And I was, you know, buying drinks for everyone, doing that. I was going for these meetings with like Stephen Moyer and agents and all of this stuff. And then she was like, come to Warner Brothers. I went to Warner Brothers. They gave me the keys to drive the little buggy round, Warner Brothers, like the writer's buggy. Have a drive.
I went, just have a drive round it.
I'll have a drive
round. I've been there, mate. I've been round.
Amazing.
Yeah. Amazing, isn't it?
Brandon Routh was there. You remember the shit Superman? He was there. He walked in front.
Well, I like
actually,
him.
He's not even a bad Superman. But it was just that movie wasn't a good Superman. A bit like Henry Cavill. I think that Henry Cavill is a good Superman, but the movie's not a good movie.
I know what you mean. You know what I mean? He got a shit time for that. Yeah. He couldn't do another movie because he was signed to a contract to do the next Superman, and therefore they left him hanging, and bless it, he couldn't work for 3 years, and everyone think, what happened to Brandon Routh? Well, that's what happened to him, poor kid. Anyway.
He was there. And
oh, great.
And I think he was driving a Porsche, so he's doing all right.
Well, you're in a little buggy, he's in a Porsche. Yeah. Similar.
So I'm going around thinking this is him, and I'm chatting to this girl. And by this point as well, kind of like nothing had happened with us. Like it just didn't really work out, wasn't going on. And our vibe changed a little bit. But
I'm sure she'll appreciate this story.
Yeah, I haven't said her name. And then So then I meet this guy called Chris, who's a director on the show, and he's like this Essex boy, and he's telling me like, yeah, we shoot an episode in 8 days, you get paid $100,000 per ep. He lived in a mansion like 5 minutes from the studio, and I was like, this is like, why are you telling me all this stuff? I've got
giving me the job.
Surely. Yeah. They loved City of Dreamers. And I remember sort of at the end of the day, she just took the keys back to the buggy and was just like, did you have a nice time? I was like, yeah, it was great. She was like, cool. See ya. And I was like, okay. Okay. By this point,
we can laugh now.
I've spent $7,000 on credit card. I'd gone to like San Francisco for 2 days for a random recce because I was trying to see if I could actually shoot something there while I was there. It was all very crazy. Anyway, I remember I'd gone out and like had a few beers, come home, and I'd gone on my NatWest app and saw like, oh, I can open a new account and get £1,000 overdraft just on my phone. So I did that. So I was doing that the whole time, spent a load of money. And then just came back with absolutely nothing. No,
but it sounds you didn't come back with absolutely nothing. You came back with a wealth of legendary stories. So I mean,
good stories.
$7,000.
If you weigh it up, I mean, an anecdote per pound, like you're doing quite well.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, when I came back and it was sort of like, I'm not in LA. I'm back at home with my folks. I'm $7,000 in debt. And I also didn't at that point have another film project. And I also was like, okay, I need to pay this money off. So I had to work, you know, get more job, go back to data inputting. I started working at a cinema as an usher. I took summer job carpet fitting with my dad to pay off that debt.
Looking back now, right, what would you do differently if that happened again? The same sort of scenario, just to help people who are going, oh, I'm going to follow my dream as well to LA and just...
But would you change it though?
Probably not.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I might not. The only thing I might let someone else buy me a drink, you know, especially when you're going out with people who are minted.
Minted, yeah. Who got £100,000 for just 8 days.
That's what really fucks me off about this industry. Yeah, you know, go out and you go out with producers and stuff like that. I remember I was in Cannes once and I was there with a producer and a very wealthy like investor. And we went to the bar and I had a Coke. I had a Coke. It was £7 or whatever for a Coke. But I was like, so I'd walked to the bar and they said, what do you want to drink, this producer? And I went, oh, I'll have a Coke. And he went, sure. And then everyone else ordered gin and tonics, all of that. He then fucked off.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was like 60 something quid. And I was like, I've had a Coke. And he's minted. And I was like, things like that happen a lot where you're just like, you go for dinner with someone and you're like, I've just seen a picture of your house on the sun. Like, why am I picking up this bill? This doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's why they're rich.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
They're not spending on drinks.
People like you. It's funny, isn't it? You have to be so careful, I think, sometimes in this world, not to let things go to your head or think because you've just won an award or whatever it is to go to, because it can easily happen and then you can get lost and it's just being clever. But like you say, you wouldn't change anything, and I don't think you should. But is there any advice you could give that younger self now? Like to say, let me just make sure I'm speaking to the right people, right? Or maybe, am I actually up for this? Would you do that? Maybe.
Yeah, I think I would. Like, I've definitely made some mistakes where my decisions were driven or motivated by just pure excitement. By going into a meeting and someone who you've never met going, you're fucking cool. I'm going to distribute your movie. I'm going to give you money for your movie. And you're like, okay, yes. I remember we signed, was it for City of Dreamers, we originally signed a distribution deal with a company. I can't remember what they were called. They're not around anymore. But the only reason we signed with them, one, they were the only person who asked for the film. But two, they just put a movie out with Paul Gross. Do you know who Paul Gross is? The greatest TV show of all time, you know, the Mountie who sells cases in Chicago with his deaf wolf.
Yeah.
Trusted hound.
And they
just
put a movie out with him. And I was like, that's it. Like, if he's the greatest actor of all time, that means this film's going to be great. And it was a weird thing. I remember that was a learning experience because they didn't pay for the film up front and they did such a bad job and they were such crooks. We ended up having to buy the movie back for, I think it was $3,000.
Oh,
so I had to buy my own movie back, which they didn't pay for. And that was one of the, I remember I lost my absolute rag on that. So I would say, it's very, when you're starting out, it is really easy to get swept up in it all. And I think that's part of the fun of it. Like, I've got funny stories to tell now. And like being 20 something years old in LA, hanging out with some of the people I did was glorious. But I think,
yes, of course,
like, it's fun in that moment. I think when now, you know, if I was going to sign a contract, you just got to take everything with a pinch of salt, enjoy it, but don't like put all your eggs in, like, you, especially in America, that they love saying, oh yeah, you're going to be the next this, you're going to do this, and then you leave the room and you never hear from them again, and you're like, what the fuck's happened there?
Over here, they just tell you no, and then they don't do it anyway. Yeah. At least you know where you're at.
And that is very true. Yeah, you know where you're at in the UK. Whereas the Duplass brothers, I think it's Mark Duplass, has a brilliant TED talk where he literally describes that. He says, I spent so long going to meetings in America, spent a year and a half of them all going, yeah, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And they're like, no, sod that. I just want to go make a movie for 20 grand, 60 grand, because I can. Whereas you lot are just talking absolute crap for ages and waiting for a star to sign and waiting for this. And it's like, you, as filmmakers, we have to make shit. As directors, if we're not doing it, we feel itchy and angsty, and we just want to do it. And I totally get why you've just gone, bang, I'm doing another one, bang, I'm doing another one.
But it's very important as well, because you do, when you're starting out, it's very tricky navigating that sales agent world. Like, you know, as Giles says, there's the excitement, but there's also the sort of pressure of like, well, I've made a film, we need to kind of go with someone that's going to do something with it. And, you know, you go into those meetings and like, yeah, we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. And the thing is, like, it's very hard to hold them accountable, and it's very hard to know who actually, you know, can sell your film or is going to, you know, put in the effort. And it's a very tricky situation of like, you know, do you just go with someone to get it out there, or do you wait in the hopes that you'll find someone else?
Yeah, it's learning the contract talk as well, which I imagine, Jamie, you've had to learn the distribution side as well. And if someone is taking your film on and you have been burnt, which I imagine you have, when a film has an okay and you go, well, I'm not getting a penny. So I imagine over time you've gone, well, let me look at these contracts. Let me just look at their expenses cap. Let me just look at who's recouping first, or, you know, whatever else it is on there, you know, no cross-collateralization, all that kind of stuff. Have you learned that? Is that something you've done yourself?
No, again, learned through making mistakes. So learned through signing contracts before I really should have signed a contract. I think distribution is the key where you get fucked a lot. Like that, you know, when we do indies, you get always into script, like you get your back end and all of these things. And like, I've never made a penny from a back end on any film I've ever made, and I've made 16 films. And a lot of that gets lost because of the distribution deal that's been done, because there's a £50,000 marketing thing when you've only made the movie for 50 grand. Or, you know, there's all these different costs that come up, or you've got 50-50 split, or there's a sales agent who's taken this cut, and then a distributor's taken this cut, and sort of 7 months down the line, you get a check for 19p, and you're like,
yes,
what happened here?
So how do you get money then if you're not getting it from the back end? Do you write that into your fees?
I kind of got taught quite early doors to try and get as much money as possible up front. And I say that, like, I don't get huge fees for my movies up front. Like, I can be entirely honest about that. Like, I think I've got £3,000 for Tucked, which is my on paper most successful film. You know, I've got a good back end in that, but whether or not I'll ever see anything in that is kind of, it's one of those things. So like when I did Tucked, I signed with Gersh in America, and that was their key thing of just like, just try and get as much of the fee up front as money in the bank, because it's real.
Yes, it's there. You can live on exactly. That. You can't live on the never.
That pays the mortgage, that pays the bills, get a back end if you can. But like, it's just, you've got to play the odds, don't you? You've got to go, if I've made 15, 16 movies and never made a penny through a back end, like, it kind of, that kind of shows. And I think it's just, it's getting harder as well for indie films to make good money, you know?
I totally agree. Yeah.
And on that note, I mean, in terms of like, you know, are you happy sort of making films in a certain budget range, or does it get to a point? Because I mean, sometimes you know you can do with guerrilla shooting and you can make it with like mates' favors, etc., etc. But there comes a point when you need to sort of, you know, raise it a little bit, and you know, then people start expecting to be, you know, paid proper rates and all this kind of stuff. How do you sort of navigate around that transition, or do you just have a group that are just really in it with you all the time?
Yeah, I have an amazing group, amazing team that. You know, we sort of swap out some people here and there, depending on the project and genre, if it's right for someone and not right for someone. But, you know, my crews are always quite small. They're generally sort of like between like 12 and 14, maybe, for the crew on the film, if not less. I feel like I've got to a point in my career now where the sort of £50,000 movie, so a Tucked, Justine, Making Tracks, whatever, I feel like I've done that to the best of my ability a lot of times, and I if I could make those sort of movies for the rest of my life, I would. But one, I can't afford to, I need to, you know, when someone, I know someone is getting $6,500 a day to do a DFS ad.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. DFS. Yeah.
The sale at your end.
Yeah. You know, you're going to give a year and a half, 2 years of your life to a movie and get, like, it's just not, it's not practical. And it's also not fair to ask my team to do that anymore, because I feel like I've asked it too many times, and they will, they go with me and they're incredible.
Of course, but.
Yeah. The next thing, and I don't expect, like, I think I've got a project with my American team, which is sort of at the $5 million budget. I'm not expecting to go from 50,000 to 5 million. The indie scene in America is very different to over here. I think the only thing I want going forward, ideally, is a little bit more time and a little bit more money for everyone just to make the film. And if that's 200,000, you know, it's realistic. And I think I've certainly done a body of work now where I can go, I think I've earned that sort of budget to be making a movie, and I can do a good job as well. I can certainly make a movie for that.
100%. You've got award-winning films under your belt that are all really fantastic, you know, that people really care about. You know, Tucked was fantastic. Jordan Stevens, who's one of your leads in it, is brilliant. I play football with Jordan, and is just fantastic in it. And, you know, Justine is just a delightful movie, you know, and I think you massively have shown you can do this. It is, and sometimes I always think people go, oh, well, the jump from 15K or whatever to, you know, 2 million. Well, it's not. You're still doing the same job. You're doing nothing different except people are getting paid. There's people around you to help you put shit around, you know?
Because if people knew the favors that you pulled in on these films, you know, the actual cost of the movie is probably like 200 grand or 300 grand. Like, you know, you're not making them like, you know, with a couple of mates with a camera, like you're still making quality film.
Absolutely. And it's an amazing achievement what you've done, Jamie. It really is a huge inspiration for anyone listening, and any filmmaker should be taking a leaf out of your book and going, hang on, look what Jamie's done here. This is incredible. And it's now, like, for you, it's like, okay, cool. You should be on that roller coaster. And it's great you signed with Gersh, and it's time to fly for you now, because you've massively achieved huge, you know, success, I believe, with your films. They're just really brilliant. Really brilliant. So, well done.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I think, I definitely think it goes back to kind of what we were talking about before. Is like, no one around me ever really has said you shouldn't be getting these sort of budgets. I think the thing that I am is I'm impatient. And I like, for my whole career, I've made a film a year. Like, before, pre-lockdown or whatever, I did three features in 10 months. You know, I did Justine, then I went into, did a movie called God's Pet, and then I did The Kindred. And it was hard, but I kind of loved it. And I thought, all I've got to do really is kind of not say yes straight away to the, if someone goes, I know I can make the movie for 50,000, but I know I should be waiting to get more. And it's that thing that I'm constantly fighting with, like, you know, like the Duplass Brothers or whatever. Do you go, oh, I just want to do it now though. Like, I could do it. I could start shooting next month. When if you sit on it and you try and get a bit more money and you package it up and, you know, you start thinking about your casting and pre-sales and all of that stuff, then, but it is, the tricky thing is always, what do I do in those gaps in the middle? You know, where I've made three films a year.
Well, you have another project on the go.
Yeah, but then doesn't it take you away from, like Jamie's saying, he's like, well, actually, it's better if potentially if I'm making a movie, because then I'm making a movie. Whereas if I'm sat waiting, I have to go work as a train driver or as a head cleaner or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and you're actually going, well, if
camel
I'm
attendant.
It's like a camel's head cleaner. But you've got to keep progressing, and you are. It's a really tricky balance where you are now, isn't it? It's really frustrating for most filmmakers, I think, when you get to that stage.
I consider myself very lucky. You know, I make a career through filmmaking, which, you know, I mean, even when I told my dad I wanted to do that, you know, he was like, what, that you can make a job? Like, because he knew Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese and didn't know.
He knew him.
So he was like, and my parents are the most supportive parents in the world. But it was also that, you know, my dad's been a carpet fitter since he was 16 and kind of never. You want a bit.
Oh, that's where I knew Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, he did his floor. My dad did actually do Laurence Olivier's floor, so that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
He said he was lovely. He made everyone a cup of tea and everything. He was a top fella. I consider myself very lucky to be making movies, and I have a lot that's going on here and in America, and I'm sure one of them will go. And yeah, if it gets to the point where I don't make anything for so long and I'm like, I need to, I also have a backup of like, scripts I could actually probably make for a lot less if I wanted to, but you know, I think of a commercial and that wouldn't be maybe, that would be doable for 50,000 without putting a lot of stress on each other. Because, you know, I didn't, obviously didn't make a movie last year. I'm trying to set something up for September this year, but I think as well as direct, like you said, we want to make stuff. Like you said, you want to stay sharp, and I would rather
you learn more making.
I'm happy to develop stuff slower and all of that stuff, but it will get to a point where I'm like, I just got to make a movie. I got to make a little movie that I can do for me and get that out there. Yeah.
I think it's really tricky as well because I come across a lot of filmmakers that they're like, okay, I'm doing my first feature. How much is the budget? Oh, I think a million or two. And you know, maybe they've done a couple of shorts. They've done nowhere near as much as you have. And you know, I think there's a couple of filmmakers out there that, you know, I know a few that have gone and done that, and they're the kind of person that will get that made through miracles, and certain things. But I think it's a tricky balance when, you know, when you're making your first feature or sort of trying to get into that, you know, that area, to aim for that kind of budget sometimes.
Mm. How do you find the money then? Because you say, oh, I might have something I can just make for 50K or whatever, somewhere around that price, maybe lower. How do you find, in all your films, how have you managed to find the money? I mean, like you say, your friends gave you the $3,000 and family for your second feature, if you like. How do you do it now? What's your process?
So most of our stuff is done through, it's private investment. So private investors is kind of how, and this is kind of, I guess, something we haven't talked about loads, but like I've always been taught, I put myself out there. So I don't necessarily like networking that much, but any opportunity I get to be in a room with new people, I will try and take it. You know, and my films have, I think we've raised 800,000 across the board, maybe a bit less for all of the films. And some of them have been really easy. When I did this movie called Court, that was a weird one because I'd had a meeting with the producer of it, a guy called Alex Francis, who he'd exec produced Moon. What was the James McAvoy, Irvin Welsh movie?
Filth.
Yeah. He'd produced that as well. And I was a big fan of Moon. So I reached out to him. He lives in Lewis. And I was like, I want to go for a coffee with him. Went for a coffee with him. He was doing this movie Court. They had a bigger director on board with it. And I remember as I left, I was just like, hey, if you lose that director, I'll do it. And about,
reported him.
3 months later, they lost their director. I came in, did it. And that was a really simple one because it was financed by American financing, Robbie Helmy Jr., his dad, who has the Hallmark Channel, just financed it. And that just happened because I'd met someone.
Networking, right? Okay.
Before, good. You know, Justine was like, I think we had 10 private investors who all put in a certain amount. And, you know, the deal is they get their money back first and then a little bit on top of that. And, you know, if you spread it, you know, I think if I do a movie for 50,000, I would rather be into 10 people for 5,000 than one person for 50,000, because most likely those people putting $5,000 into the movie, it's not that lump of sum money where it's going to ruin their lives or it's going
to. No, it's just for fun. Yeah, if I lose it, we lose
exactly.
It. Look, it's $5,000.
They're excited to be
and
producing.
And we can put a name to it.
Yeah, producing a film comes to the premiere, all of that. So
that's barely a trip to
exactly.
LA.
Exactly. I've also done crowdfunding. I've done that a few times. It's certainly for me, it's something I can't do for a while now. I've done it two or three times, and I think each time it's got progressively a little bit worse. And I think,
what's the most you think you've raised on crowdfunding? I think there is definitely a limit you can get from your network.
I think we did $11,000, maybe.
That's quite a lot. Yeah,
we did for Fractured. I think we got seven and a half maybe. But it's just tough because everyone's doing it, and it's just...
and it's a full time job when you're doing it. So it's like, oh my god, and it can be painful. It can be hard. Like I say, you can only do it so many times where people go, yeah, all right, I did your last one, and yeah, I didn't hear from you. So, well, in your case, they will have, and you know, you've got some great stuff to show for it, which is incredible. Have you never had anything from like the BFI,
never.
From funding bodies? This blows my fucking mind. Why someone like yourself, who's making movies that are absolutely perfect for their system, their scheme, you should be on their radar. This is God's Own Country stuff. And how are you not getting funding from funding bodies? Blows my mind. For me, this is why the British cinema industry is fucked at the moment, because they should be supporting you.
Yeah, they're not really here to, you know, to help people that are like passionate people that have the ability to make good films. They're
Are they not? I mean, surely that is why they're here. I mean, I know there's many reasons, there's all the tax, but all this kind of stuff that's going into it. But at the same time, there's a big loop and jumps you've got to go through to get them to like you and want your films. Have you applied?
We have applied. We've applied numerous times for different grants, lottery funding, BFI funding.
I want to get someone on and ask them why the fuck you wouldn't even look. Have you actually been in meetings?
No, never been in a meeting.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
And we've always had projects as well that are very, that tick all the boxes. You know,
Of course you have. Look, they tick the boxes. Your movies tick the boxes of what they're looking for in these movies. LGBT friendly. You know, this is, you're ticking the boxes. A guy who's made movies for little money needs help, is perfect for them, and yet you don't even get through the door. I honestly don't understand it. I find that disgusting. I don't get how we're not supporting our filmmakers.
I think what I always found really, I mean, certainly with Tuts, BFI love Tuts. You know, we played Flair, we premiered there. Like, there was a lot of support from BFI, and then it just sort of, nothing came from it. But I know the thing that always annoys me is when you see movies which are made by established, and I mean people like, and I love Ben Wheatley, I love Shane Meadows, I love Ken Loach, all of these, they're incredible filmmakers, but I don't necessarily feel like they need funding. I feel like they're in positions where
they could get funding from investors.
Yeah, and they get awards like first time filmmaker and like, you know, rising star. And it's like, hang on, they've already risen. They're up fucking next to the North Star. Like, they're doing it. Like, they've had big budgets. They could go and finance this themselves without the BFI. It seems to be like the idea is that they get people that, you know, could do it without them. And then they're like, well, you know, maybe now you don't want us, we'll give you the money.
Well, there's an interesting documentary about it called Who Killed British Cinema. It's on Amazon, which is free now on Amazon Prime. And it's really interesting about how they feel it works. And, it you know, there's a lot that's going into this and why funding bodies aren't giving it to certain people, especially like yourself, which to me, honestly, I don't get it. Anyway, look, let's talk about Justine, because it's such a delightful, wonderful movie, brilliantly well made. You know, how many days did you shoot for? You didn't shoot for many days, did you,
10.
On this one?
Yeah, I did it in 10 days.
10 days. Okay, that's pretty impressive. And your budget, again, you said it was around 15K, right?
It was around, what did we do? It was around 55 or something like that.
55, yeah. Right. Again, massively impressive. You know, look what you've achieved on this. It's a gorgeous looking movie. Your cinematographer on this one's Paul O'Callaghan. You know, when you're sort of coming up with an idea like this, you know, and the movie before Tucked, well, before, there's so many movies you've done. But in terms of, you know, it's the LGBT strand, is that the Brighton-esque side of you wanting to push that angle? Where do these stories come from for you?
Well, I mean, Tucked was different. Tucked was like, every character in Tucked is kind of a version of someone I've met in Brighton at some point in my life. And it was, you know, that was inspired by Nights Out, people I've met, and kind of the city I love and adore. I think when Justine came, so Jeff Murphy, who wrote Justine, he'd won a BAFTA, and he did a TV show called Hidden, which I think has just gone in for a new series, and Hinterland, and was kind of, it kind of came to me, that script, quite sort of last minute. It all happened very quickly. I'd done Tuts and stuff, and that script came in, and I really liked the character of Justine. I thought it was an interesting character. I remember when I was reading it, I was fully expecting at some point it was going to get like, oh, okay, well, something really bad happened to her in her childhood, and she came from a bad neighborhood. And then it was like, oh, actually, no, that wasn't the story. That's not this movie. That's not this character. And I found that quite interesting. And, you know, at the heart of that movie, it's a love story, which is, you know, I think there's themes of that in every movie I've ever done. So that really connected with me. It was, you know, I'm at this weird thing of like, there's certain, it's directing someone else's material is always a little bit different. I've done it a few times now, because you never know, you kind of want to put your twist on it, your edge on it, but then you're like, but also, you know, this is written by a BAFTA winner, and this is that, and it's like, oh, what do I know enough about it? I remember with that, my key thing was I didn't want to do too much work on the script, but it was really important that we workshopped it with Tallulah and Sophie, who are the two leads, because it also just felt like this doesn't need another male voice opinion in this one, you know what I mean? It was like, what do I have to add to it? Whereas I think, you know, what Tallulah and Sophie brought to it by workshopping and really getting involved in those scenes, like, I think the script became just a little bit. And certainly the characters, you know, we just understood the film we all wanted to make together a little bit more.
Well, just to give our audience a little bit about what it's about, and then I'll drop the trailer in. It's a love story set against a backdrop in Brighton and tracked by a violent and puzzling tale of a young woman's descent into self-destruction. She meets Rachel and love takes over. At first it heals, but Justine's pain goes deep.
Do you ever think about dying?
Everyone thinks about dying. It's attractive.
What's attractive about dying, Justine?
Not feeling anything.
So what do you want to do?
Justine.
Rachel.
Tell me something about you. Something I don't know.
The past can be a terrible thing. I don't particularly want one.
The best thing you can do is just keep your nose out of it, yeah?
Hello? Justine?
Okay, Doc.
You have to stop drinking.
When I drink, I feel safe.
I can make you feel safe.
What's the point of all this? We'll end in tears.
Oi! Honestly, it's just a well made movie. You're talking there about, you know, developing it and making it work. Obviously, you know the area, you know how you can do it. Was the money in place already at this point?
Or? So we money was in place. We'd planned to shoot three movies back to back, all for a similar budget, and then that kind of fell through. So we ended up just kind of doing the one and seeing how it was going to work, and then. Post-production on this took a lot longer than we thought. Then we were supposed to premiere at BFI Flare, and then we went into lockdown. We had a 750-seater sold out at BFI Southbank, which would have been amazing.
It would have been amazing.
So,
yeah.
And we the whole time we're going, we need a festival run. And obviously had zero festival run with the movie. So we always felt a little bit up against it with it. The shoot was easy. It was done at 21 locations in 10 days and stuff. It should have been hard. But it wasn't. It felt like it was quite a smooth shoot. It was just when we went into post with it, just one or two things started happening where you're like, okay, that's a bit tricky. Okay, now we need to get over that. Oh, now we need to sort this. And now there's a rights thing and all of this stuff, which all got sorted, but all took time and money as well. Now it's kind of, we're in this position where Curzon picked it up and took it on an exclusive, and we're so happy to finally get the movie out there. I think that's the, you know what it's like when it's just gone, this has been like two and a bit years. It's been finished for a year and a bit, but it's just trying to find someone to partner up with it. And also, let's be honest, it's not been the easiest sell in the last year. You know, it's quite a heavy drama where, you know, people certainly for a while didn't want to sit at home and watch quite a heavy movie about, you know, an alcoholic, depressed love story type movie.
How do you balance that in the writing stage? Because especially at the start of the movie, you know, you lay on quite heavily with the, you know, the main character, you know, a lot of the sort of troubles and her lifestyle. You know, how do you sort of balance that with, you know, the seriousness versus the kind of the warmth of building of the love story?
Well, so Jeff, I remember Jeff, because this was a script that was written years ago. I want to say 2012, might have even been before then. And it was loads of research had gone into it, and it had been with other production companies and other people way before it came to me. So it kind of gone through this development process already. When I got it, it was a bit similar to when I did Tucked. Like Tucked touches on a lot of really important themes to me about sexuality, about toxic masculinity, about age, all of these stereotypes, all of these things. But it starts the conversation. It doesn't finish it. You know, it's not me going, hey, this is what I think about this, this, and this. And with Justine, what I thought was similar about it was like, it was a love story. It is a love story, but it is just, it's rooted in this kind of, you know, this world of, you know, Justine is angry. She's angry at the world she lives in, but it isn't, you know, it's not a story of an alcoholic, if that makes, it's someone who's kind of rebelling against life, rebelling against the world, and is essentially lost. And, you know, all of these reasons add up to why she, you know, the breakdown of the relationship with her family, you know, what happened to her dad, you know, kind of the drinking, like what happened at school, you know, always felt like a bit of an outsider. But it's not a movie about an alcoholic. It's a movie about these two people falling in love. And I think what we wanted to do, what was clear with it, was there isn't that many lighthearted moments in the movie. But there is these subtle little looks, these subtle little, you know, just a stroke of the finger. The sex scene, for instance, is one of my favorite scenes. I'm very proud of that, everything I've shot, because what I think it does is it's realistic. You know, for me, the sex wasn't the interesting bit. It was everything that happens before. It's the first kiss. It's the clothes coming off. It's the looks, mm-hmm. the awkwardness, mm-hmm. the quietness.
It was very sensitive.
Yeah, all the trousers, you know, trousers don't just glide off, you know.
No,
it
they
doesn't
don't.
Happen. Yeah. It's really clunky. And I think that's what I love. And I think the movie, and this might sound weird, it's got this kind of clunky, rough around the edges feel to it, because that's what life is. That's what love is. You know, it isn't this glossy, beautiful Netflix sheen where everything's perfect. And, you know, in the sex scene, the penis just slides beautifully into the vagina. There's no condom. Everyone comes. It's wonderful. And you're like, that's not life. That's not real. And I think this is where this movie kind of works. And I think I remember someone asked me about, they were like, it's quite a sad movie in parts. And I was like, well, yeah, it is. But I don't think that's a bad thing, because in all, like, how do we know what happiness feels like if you're never sad? You know, it's this idea of like, yes, it is sad, but hopefully it gets happy and there's hope in it. You know, you've got the feeling of happiness doesn't exist without the feeling of sadness. And I think so many movies just, they focus on the happy, happy, happy. And then normally something happens. Oh, she says something, gets overheard and shit hits the fan. Then it all ties up nice, like neatly in a bow. You know, I don't necessarily want to always do that with my movies. And I think when you work at this budget range as well, you have that little bit more creative freedom to leave it maybe a little bit more open than had we have done it for a million with Netflix or whatever.
Yeah, I love that. What about when you're directing in those situations and getting your actors to certain place? Because like I say, your actors have to go really deep place, not only casting the right people, but also what do you do, you know? And Tucked is the same, Justine's the same, to get in the mindset. What's your process? How do you talk to the actors? What's the best way you find to talk to actors?
So I mean, I've always said that I think the main job of a director is like casting. I feel like if you cast something right, you shouldn't have to go in and be like note after note after note after note, because once you've given that role, you've cast that role, that's their character. It's like you've entrusted them to do it. So I've always think, you know, casting is something I take obviously very seriously. You know, when I was starting out, I used to put a lot of friends and stuff in stuff. You know, you do that when you're starting out, but you know, it's so crucial to make sure you cast every part. And also, like, even if there's two lines in a film or three lines, someone can come in and butcher three lines and ruin a whole movie. Like,
it's so true, isn't it?
It takes you out of it.
You just put someone in because they're a mate. Yeah, you go,
it really does. You're like, oh, that was shit. And then you become aware you're watching a film, and then you've lost the audience, and then you've got to work to get them back. And that's just the damage of two lines. If you cast one of the leads wrong, like that film's never working. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a particularly technical director. You know, I do stick men for my storyboards. I know the whole film kind of in my head before I'm there. My thing has always been that it's about creating an environment on set where everyone feels safe, everyone feels happy, supported to do the best work possible. Because I can't do it. I can't do it on my own. Look, when I try and do it on my own, swimming in circles happens. Like when, you know, I can't operate a camera, I can't do sound, I can't do makeup, I can't do, like, it's a team effort. And it's very important for me that everyone is on the same level. There is no sort of hierarchy, really. We're all in this together, especially, like I say, when, you know, it's a crew of like 12 or 14 people. Like, we work very closely together. So it's, I think it's about, they're there because I think they're the best person for the job. They know that. And it's just about us all supporting each other to do the best job possible. So that's kind of, that's always been my approach for it. I've been on some sets before where it's a little, there's a bad atmosphere on a set can kill it. Yeah. Like, it just kills it.
All it takes is one person that's got a bit of a shitty attitude or doesn't want to be there, or they don't feel like they're being paid enough. And it's like, you know, just don't take the job. If you know the deal, just don't
take
the job.
Don't do it. Don't be it. Don't complain about it. Yeah, we don't want people complaining. Amazing. Was there anything you learned on this, on making Justine, that you take forward? I mean, you've made so many. I mean, I imagine, and like you say, it was a year or so ago when you made it. And now looking for your next one, hopefully very soon in September, what are you going to bring from all the films you've learnt so far? What's a nice bit of tip for someone moving forward?
What was great about Justine is we used a lot of natural light on it. So we didn't spend ages. I mean, you guys know lighting kills your schedule. You know, it's important, you know, to match it. You move one little thing, it's a nightmare. So what was great about Justine was that freedom we kind of had of just stick that lamp on. We'll put one little light up or so. And it worked for the look of that film and the feel of that film. So I think, you know, I always take stuff going into, you know, like scheduling things of, you know, I shouldn't have scheduled all of this in one day. Next time on the next one, we'll try and really look at that schedule. But then you get to a point where you're just like, well, this actor's only free on this day and this, we can only do it this way. So I think, you know, going into, I think I just take it's combined of everything I've ever learned on a film. You know, I want to have a great food table, craft. Yeah, you want to have good biscuits,
craft services. Yeah,
I'm there with you there.
Things like that. Yeah, it sounds like really like simple, but like having good snacks.
It's important.
Everyone who's going to work on the film, whatever we do, we email them, you know, privately and say like, what's your favorite snacks? What's going to give you a little pick?
Ooh,
yeah.
Something like that.
I like that. Make sure you bring
them. Because we haven't got them. So
we ain't got none for you.
Because I remember there was Paul, our DP, for the first couple of movies we did together. He used to sneak off into his van where he had this like really expensive dark chocolate, like fancy shit that he knew he couldn't ask for because it was like £4 a bar or something. And he used to just go over there and come back and he'd be, oh, what are you doing? He says, I've got a bit of chocolate. And then he'd tell one person, he'd tell another person. And then all of a sudden everyone's eating his chocolate. So now it's like, well, okay, we've done a lot of movies together. So now we get him his chocolate. But I think, you know, little touches like that, they do go a long way on a film set. You know, I love Pop-Tarts. Like Pop-Tarts are my thing. Like, it's just that sugar hit. And I never really eat them at home. But like, for some reason, get me on a set, I love a Pop-Tart.
Yeah. You find your little home comforts on set that you don't have at home. You have your little set thing, whether it's a coffee in first thing when you might not do that, or it's a biscuit at a certain time when you wouldn't do that. But
or slippers on your one.
I had slippers because we were in a house and a freezing cold floor.
There were some very fancy slippers, actually.
Yeah, there were some fancy. Everyone knew to bring slippers because it was cold, they got told. So we all had slippers. But I'd love it if they were branded. Imagine that. You're on a film so big that they give you
branded slippers. That's the dream.
That's the dream, mate. That is the dream.
That's when we all will know we've made it.
It will. It will. This, Jamie, this has been amazing. We could talk forever. And I can't wait to get you back on because obviously making The Kindred, which was Stephen Tracy Isles, were one of the producers on it, which is fantastic. And maybe when that comes out, it'd be great to get you back on to talk about that. It'd be really, really cool. But Justine is out now on Curzon Home Cinema. Please go support. And if the BFI are listening, you should be ashamed of yourself for not speaking to Jamie.
Why do you hate Jamie so much?
Why don't you like us, BFI?
Totally. It's not just BFI, but any funding body like that. You should be looking at filmmakers like this. I totally agree. So if you are listening, take fucking note. Jamie, thank you so much. Honestly, your time's been incredible. What a legend. Your story's
been incredibly fun episode.
Really fun, really fun. Where can people find you on the socials so they can bombard you with stories of LA?
Yeah, what am I? J_Patterson86, I think is my Twitter. That's the old Twitter. And
you can change it now. But
yeah, I don't know. I'm not very good with the old social. I go through periods of, if I've got something coming out, I'm great, I'm on it. It's the time in between. I'm like, do people really want to see my lunch, or do they really want to see what, like?
No, but what you can do is tweet. What's good about this, and it's so important, because the problem is if you only just do it when your film's coming out, people, you get dropped off everyone's list. So
yeah, then I keep them hooked with memes, and it keeps them happy. Like
memes.
Memes. No, from now on they're going to be called memes. I love that.
Yeah, from now on I'm going to be just putting Orlando Bloom memes up everywhere. But what you can do is just, even if you just retweet or like someone else's or comment, that looks cool, it just keeps you in the loop. I know it's hard, it's not easy, but it is actually important when you need to tell someone about your projects.
Yeah,
it is important to have. So you're on Twitter.
J_Patterson86
and the same on Instagram. Brilliant. I'll put little links to that in the show notes. I'll try and put as many films as I can. Actually, Jamie, if you send me those links, then I can do it much easier than me trying to find
all of them. Every single
16 films. I want links to all of them, or just whichever ones you want to show us. That'd be amazing. This has been absolutely brilliant. I'm Jos Olson. You can find me at Jos Olson on all the socials, the Filmmakers Pod at Filmmakers Pod. Dom, yourself?
I am Dom Lenoir. You can find me at Director Dom Lenoir on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as well.
Amazing. Listen, if you've not learnt from Jamie today, and he's not inspired you, then what are you doing? Go out there and make your film just as Jamie has done. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty to send the elevator back down. I am going to go call Orlando Bloom's mum and borrow her mop and maybe play some hockey with it. So, happy days. Until next Tuesday, Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Dom, take care.
You too.
Go and watch Justine, everyone. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.